Boy, I'm glad Vanessa's not here because we didn't pick Facebook, and Facebook just exploded because, believe it or not, idiots, I mean people, are clicking on those mobile ads. Keep coming, keep coming, keep coming, keep coming, keep coming. No, she didn't drop the class. She's going to the Super Bowl. And so we're taking a look at, yeah. No, I don't know what your Facebook is. No, she won some contest. She won some contest. No, she did not pay him for it. She won some contest, and she's taking her father. Yes. Question? Oh, yeah, pick your own. So here is what we did. I added Wells Fargo, and I will get rid of... We didn't get rid of DuPont. I don't remember. I thought we did. But well, we kept Triple D. Triple D jumped, really dove, but today it's up 3.5%. But we're only down 3.5%, folks. And what I do is I start from the beginning of the semester, so I start from January 21st. So if we were to just get rid of the first 2 weeks, it wouldn't look so bad. But hey, you know, you live by the sword, you got to die by the sword. So what we'll do every day is we'll take a look and see how we're doing. And so far, it's all red. Yeah, all in the red. We've made some losses. And look at 3M down. I don't know. That's a pretty good stock.
Waste management, how are we doing?
Waste management only down 3%, but that's what you expect. Look at the bank. Wells Fargo only down 1%. And Costco not doing too well. Wells Fargo, I threw it in there. I wanted 10 stocks. Okay. Yeah, I know, banks. When you grow up, folks, you want to be a bank. All right. Now, we're going to get started on mutual funds, but first, we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? What? All right. Right. It's a good joke.
I don't know if it's good or not.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, not good. You didn't even... I said, I got plenty of bad jokes. Give me good jokes.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
I don't know if it's good, but what happens if you eat yeast and shoe polish?
Oh, that sounds all bad.
No. Yeast and shoe polish. Yeah. You get a rising black something.
Okay.
I don't know what.
Every morning you rise and shine.
Rise and shine, right. Yeah, Lisa right over here, okay. Well, you got to bring good jokes. I mean, let's hear a good one. Can't create a hostile environment. But you can't create a hostile environment.
Okay. A guy walks in the bar and orders a H2O. And a guy watches him and he's like, can I have an H2O2? And he dies.
Because H2O2 is hydrogen peroxide. So he has an H2O2 too, and yeah, you could, okay, that's good. Okay. All right, so we got, that's a good class. Yeah, you ought to see my Monday, Wednesday class. Like, huh? It's the Monday, Wednesday group. Okay, so mutual funds. Now, before we start, just let me say that some people who teach, or some books, or some people, and profs who teach this class, they put mutual funds after we've gone through stocks and bonds and a few others. And then others, such as our book, put it before. And there are pros and cons from both directions. I like to do it before for a few various reasons. One of the best ones is that as you're slogging through stocks and you're going, I don't think I'm ever going to be interested in doing this. I'm going to give you some assignments to do and you're going to hate them. Or maybe you love them, and if you do love them, that's a really good sign. At the very least, you'll know that, hey, somebody will do this for me. I don't have to do it. I don't have to do it myself. Because what are mutual funds? They are investments for the masses. And we already said that, so we're going to run through this quickly, folks. Hopefully I don't go too fast. If I do, just scream and holler, and I'm writing down two things for myself, but you don't have to worry about them. Just ignore them. I'm writing them for myself. What are they? They are, is that he sitting in that spot right there?
Yeah.
Okay. Have a seat right there. Okay, you can steal his seat. There's a seat right here. They are investment companies. They invest their shareholders' money in a diversified portfolio of securities. As we said, investment company is a legal term. Mutual fund is the popular term. You will not hear people use the term investment company unless they're in the industry. You get two wonderful things, professional money management and diversification. Each fund has a specific objective, as outlined in the prospectus, and there are over 10,000 funds to choose from. How could that be true? How could there be that many things? Well, as we're going to see as we go along, the industry started off fairly simple enough, but then just started multiplying and multiplying and multiplying because these things are very profitable and they're pretty darn easy to set up. Many people choose mutual funds for their retirement account investments, 401ks, 403bs, traditional IRAs, Roth IRAs. Chances are, dear students, when you enter the benevolent machine and are trading your life for your paycheck and your paycheck for the rent and the mortgage and the orthodontia and the car payments, you're going to be offered a 401k plan or some other employer-sponsored plan for your retirement. And mutual funds will invariably be the choices in your 401k plan. Here's my wonderful graphic. Don't you just love it?
Love.
Isn't it great?
Great.
I did it myself. Here we are with the little people, and we put $50, $100 a month into the mutual fund, and we give it to the people in the top hats. And these people are the professional money managers. They go by various names, mutual fund managers, portfolio counselors. They go by various names, but they are making pretty good money, folks, for what they do. And you've got to, and some of you might be interested in doing that, but you better go to Harvard or Stanford or one of the bigger colleges because, oh boy, don't they love to see you be one of the stars. And it turns out that more and more of the investors are women and more of the investment professionals are women, and it turns out the women make better investors. And they create a mutual fund, a pool of money. That's what it's supposed to look like. Does it look like a pool? Okay. And if they buy stocks, it's called a stock mutual fund. If they buy bonds, it's called a bond mutual fund. And if they mix the two, it's called a balanced mutual fund. And we begin to see the bifurcation, the balkanization, the breaking up of the industry into little bitty pieces. If they buy the cash instruments, they're called money market mutual funds, but as we said, the mutual fund disappears and we just call it a money market. Going too fast? Okay. Look at the growth of the industry. In 1940, we had the Investment Company Act of 1940. Investment Company Act, Investment Company, mutual funds. Before that, there were mutual funds, but they were existing in a gray area. And different states regulated them differently, and the feds kind of scratched their head, didn't know what to do with it. And here's an example of what our Congress can do when they get their act together. The Investment Company Act of 1940 is still pretty much intact the way it was, you know, 70 years ago, and serving the industry pretty well. From 1940 to 1970, the industry grew from 70 to 340, 350 mutual funds. 600 between 1970 and 80. Look at what happened in the 80s. From 600 to 2000, and then here's the explosion. The 1990s, the internet bubble, the stock market exploded on the upside, and everybody was interested in investing, so the mutual fund industry did thou likewise. It exploded. And now, as of 2012, there were 10,593 mutual funds, give or take a few up and down. Where do I get this information? From ICI.org. And for those of you who are statisticians extraordinaires, you'll want to go to the ICI.org website. But, that's the mother loan. But they're now charging $600 a year to get all the stuff. They give you, they give you a lot of information and pretty much everything I need so far. But we'll see. If they, the fact book for 2013 hasn't come out yet. With all the 2013 data, we'll see if they make that per use, what, $600 a year? But that's the Trade Institute. That's the nonprofit trade organization for the investment company, for the industry, for the mutual fund industry. So what's going on? In 1980, there were 5 million Americans who owned funds, holding about 3% of their household financial assets. As of December 2012,
2012, that was the year that it was included, the open-end.
Okay, we're going to describe what open-end, close-end, and ETFs are in just a bit. There are There are a few other types of investment companies. All mutual funds are investment companies, but not all investment companies are mutual funds. There's a few other types of investment companies that are very, very tiny piece of the universe. So we just basically get rid of them. And it turns out that closed-end funds are really not that popular, but you should know them and we will include them. You might decide someday to invest in a closed-end mutual fund. But the action is in the open-end world, and the new action is in the ETF world. So did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I remember talking about the open-end.
Open-end, closed.
This bar was only like 2012 or
2019. Yeah, this is 2012. And in fact, the ETFs have been exploding, the number of ETFs, as we'll see in a few slides. However, the growth has slowed down a bit. The growth has the meteoric growth has slowed down. So, 30-some-odd years ago, mutual funds were 3% of household financial assets. As of December 2012, they were holding 23% of household assets. So, from 5 million to 92.4 million. 53.8 million households, that's a little less than half of the households. So, every other household is a mutual fund owner. Why? 401k plans, 403b plans, employer-sponsored plans where your retirement now is being managed by you. And we'll discuss that later on. We discussed it quite a bit in the 121 class. Why is that? Not because the old traditional pension plan is such a bad deal for the companies. It's people are living longer. And so the companies that set up these traditional benefit plans, these defined benefit plans are called traditional pension plans that said, you worked for us for this many years, you made this much money, you're this old, this is how much we're going to pay you for the rest of your life. Well, when people lived an extra 5 years after retirement, it wasn't a big deal. But now people are living 25 years or more out of retirement. And the companies are going, wait a minute, we don't want to deal with this anymore. We're going to give it to you. We're going to let you worry about it. And that's why mutual funds are so important, because they're, for the most part, the investment and vehicle for these things. Mutual funds are now the nation's largest financial intermediary, followed by commercial banks and then life insurance companies, the invisible bankers. Looking back, so we got as of November of 2013, so we don't have the 2013 all data yet. This was, what's going on here? Okay, assets, $16.7 trillion as of November 2013. At the end of 2012, that number was $14.7 trillion. So 2013 was a pretty good deal, extra couple trillion. At the end of 2011, it was $13 trillion. 2010, $13.1 trillion. 2009, $12.1, $6 trillion. End of 2008, $10. And 2007, $13. So you see the dip? Boosh! In 2008, ouch, it went down. As we discussed in Chapter 1, 2008 was a very rough year. Now, this doesn't look that bad, actually. Oh, it just went down $3 trillion from here. Why is that? Because about $2 or $3 trillion at any one time are sitting in money market mutual funds. So the bond funds and the stock funds, if you take out the extra $3 trillion or so in the money markets, it was a much bigger drop, because mutual funds don't go down. Okay, am I going too fast? No? Go like this. Help, I'm losing you. What are the advantages? Well, we said, what's the big advantage? If somebody asks you, say on an exam, what are mutual funds? What are you going to say? He's reading it down. You're going to say something about the pooled investments, right? It's people pool their money to put. But what are the advantages? Diversification and professional money management. Diversification allows investors to buy in a diversified portfolio of securities for the collective benefit of the individual investors. This variety provides some safety that is difficult for an individual investor to obtain on their own. The mutual fund investors and managers, the mutual fund portfolio counselors, the managers, whatever you call them, they don't buy 10 companies like we're doing. They buy 100 or 200 companies. So if one company goes into the porcelain oasis, it's not a big deal. Of course, if you have a concentrated portfolio and one company does really well, you're going to make the mutual fund managers look sad. But you're not comparing apples to apples, right? You're comparing apples to oranges. A concentrated portfolio can make you very happy or very sad. Whereas a mutual fund is not going, they're not supposed to. That's not the reason they're in existence. It's not going to explode on the up. Some do, but most don't. But all, at the same time, you're not going to have huge losses. Are the mutual fund managers paid well?
No.
Oh, yes, they are. They are paid extremely well. They are supposed to know what they're doing. And then, one of the things that makes mutual funds so easy for people is the low initial outlay. Most companies will allow you to set up an automatic payment plan, $50 a month, some as little as $25 a month. Now, they don't want you to send them a check every month. You understand? They don't want you to send them a check for $50 every month because it costs them $5, $10 just to process the check. But if they set up your bank information, or you do it online, set up your bank information so that you're automatically contributing from your savings account or your checking account, cool. It doesn't cost them anything. It costs them pennies. Are you with me? Understand? And one of the best things about mutual funds is the PETA factor. Now, I wish I had come up with this, but I didn't. I got it from the Wealthy Barber. PETA stands for, anybody remember? Pain in the... Right, exactly. Pain in the... It's true. It's true. Once you've made your decision about which mutual funds you want, and you've done good research, you stay away from them. That's their job. That's their job. Now, that doesn't mean you should ignore them. You should look at judiciously. I like that word, judiciously. Take a look at them every 6, 8 months, 10 months, every year. But for the most part, you forget about them. Now, what are the drawbacks? Is this a non-for-profit organization? Are they doing it out of the goodness of their hearts? No, they're out to make money, and oh boy, do they make money. And some mutual funds charge sales fees called loads, front-end loads, back-end loads. Many others are no-load funds. There's no transaction cost. There's no commission. There's no sales charge. But there are annual operating expenses. Every mutual fund, every investment, has annual operating expenses. And so some no-load funds, if they have high annual operating expenses, can wind up costing you more than a load fund, especially over time. So we'll watch out for that, and we'll get to it today. We'll start. I don't know if we'll finish. And many mutual funds don't match the market's performance. Wait a minute. These people are getting paid very good, very well. They're being paid very well. Can't they beat the market? Well, some of them can. Some of them can. A lot of them don't. Think about it. If you're the market, if you're the Standard & Poor's 500, and what is that? We're going to be making references to it, but we're not going to discuss it in detail until we get to Chapter 5, one of the problems of putting mutual funds before the others. But the Standard & Poor's 500 is the list of 500 largest companies in the United States. And this index, this benchmark, is often the measurement by which many mutual funds are measured. But if you're the index, you don't have any transaction costs. You're just a list of 500 companies. Whereas the mutual fund managers, and you, if you're an individual investor, you don't get these stocks for free. You have to pay commissions every time you buy and sell the shares. So the mutual fund managers have to pay money to do their transactions, whereas there's no transaction costs in the Standard & Poor's 500. Plus, the mutual fund managers, their job is to go out and knock on the door of GM and knock on the door of Ford and Toyota and Honda and say, well, which one should I buy? Or maybe I should buy BMW. And that costs money. Good mutual fund organizations have analysts all around the world. Because you think you're investing in a company that's based in the United States and more than 50% or 80% of its of its money is coming out from outside the United States. So good mutual fund managers and mutual funds cost a bit to run. So you understand what's going on here? You have to beat these fees just to get even with the index. Make sense? And we're going to see that some mutual funds have said, well, we're not even going to try. We're never going to try to beat the index. We'll try to match the index as closely as possible. And how they do that, we'll see that in a bit. Make sense? Am I going too quickly? I feel you guys are just sitting there like this. What, did I lose you? No, okay. Well, I don't want to lose people. I'm not up here just for my health. I want you guys to learn. Now, in a financial planning and money management class, we don't even make this distinction. But here we are, folks. We're in the introduction to investment class, and we need to know the difference between an open end and a closed end mutual fund. Even though, as we'll see, the closed end mutual fund world is starting to peter out, starting to disappear. Open-end mutual funds are a type of investment company in which investors buy shares from and then sell them back to the mutual fund itself. You give your money to the mutual fund, they create new shares, and then when you want your money back, you say, I want my money back, they destroy those shares. There is no limit to the number of shares that they can create. Hence, open-end. Make sense? Open-end. Shares are issued and redeemed by the investment company at the request of investors. Investors can buy shares from, purchase, sell shares to, redeem the investment company at any time. And when people refer to mutual funds, they are almost always, they are almost always discussing open-end. Unless they say, oh, I bought a closed-end fund, or I bought an ETF. Because these are the big ones. Like more than 80% of the mutual fund industry are open-end mutual funds. As of December 2012, 8,752 funds out of the 10,500 were open-end, totaling $13 trillion out of the $16 trillion we looked at. And look, at the end of this is the end of December. At the end of November 2013, it was $14.8 trillion. So 2013 was a very good year for stock mutual funds. Yes? No, somebody doesn't know the code, and they opened up the door, and then, No, it's not. That's not the fire alarm. If it was a fire alarm, you watch me. I'll be the first one out. if you think I'm a hero or something like that, forget it. Cowards run in my family. Yeah, and that's why also you don't want to sit here because if there's an active shooter, they're going to be the first one shot, right? So you don't want. So don't. Isn't it fun when I think I'll be under the table cowering? We had this seminar where we were supposed to, what would you do? And people were saying, I would do anything possible. I was like, are you kidding? My students better run faster than me. It's all I can say. you think, terrible? The one thing we can't do is we can't lock the door from the inside. No, we have to go outside, lock the door, and then go back in. So that's the fire. Fire marshal says you can't lock the door from the inside. You can lock it from the outside, but everybody has to be able to get out. But when there's a shooter, I don't want to miss. Anyway, okay. Now, what are closed-end mutual funds? Look, 5% of the mutual funds out there. These are a type of investment company that operates with a fixed number of shares. So the big difference is that open-ends have an unlimited amount of shares. If you want more shares, they'll give them to you. If you want your money back, they'll destroy them. Whereas the fixed amount of shares means that the closed-end fund, once they have issued all the shares to new shareholders, once they've taken all the original shares and sold them, they're out of the game. The closed-end mutual fund no longer is involved in selling and buying shares back. That's almost like a stock. Because once the stock... Okay, yeah, turn them off. I know some of you are watching them and texting. And just turn them off. So once those shares are out there, however many shares there are, 5 million or 10 million or 100 million, those shares now trade like a stock. They're out there on the exchanges. And if you want one, you have to buy them. If you want to buy shares, you have to buy them from another investor. So you have to go through your brokerage firm. You don't go to the mutual fund company and buy shares from and sell shares to. Does that make sense, folks? Okay, so the difference, that's what we call open-end, unlimited, closed-end, fixed, or limited. Closed-end investment companies are not as popular with individual investors as open-end investment companies. At the end of 2012, there were only 602 of them, holding $265 billion. So $14 trillion in these guys, $265 billion in these guys. You see the big difference? They're a tiny part, and it's shrinking. By the end of 2013, or November, there were 604 of them holding 277. So these things are becoming less and less important in the industry. Net asset value. The net asset value is a calculation that the book asks you to do, and I don't ask you to do it because it's done for you. And it's not that hard. But every day, according to the Investment Company Act of 1940, every day that the market is open, the mutual fund company has to go out there and find the ending price of the securities that they hold, the stocks, bonds, whatever, and they have to calculate what the mutual fund is worth. So it's a very simple calculation. The hard part is finding all the quotes. Add up the value of the securities in the mutual fund, subtract any liabilities. Well, this is normally small. People are selling their shares, or you're buying some more securities, so you have some liabilities that haven't been, the check hasn't been sent yet. And then you divide by the number of shares. Open-end mutual funds are sold at net asset value once a day. And, of course, if there's a sales charge, then sales charge is added. But closed-end mutual funds trade like a stock on the exchange. So closed-end mutual funds are bought and sold on the open market. Therefore, their price usually either reflects a premium or a discount to the net asset value, often a discount. They are very rarely priced at their net asset value. So these folks will always be priced at their NAV, whereas these, they'll either be priced above that or below that, depending on the market forces. So you'll look and you'll say, "Ooh, this mutual fund has $25 worth of securities every share, and it's selling for $24.50. You can buy $25 worth of securities for $24.50. Cool, right? But then when you go to sell it, what are they going to sell it at? $4.50, right? The discount will still be there. Now, if the closed-end fund gets popular, it might sell at a premium. So there are market forces here. There are no market forces in the purchase and sales of these shares, of the mutual fund itself. I mean, the securities are going up and down every day, all the time. Does that make sense? I don't know what the hell he's talking about, but we all had fun playing with the pencils on our desk. Yeah, and here's the calculation. The value of the fund's portfolio minus the liability divided by the number of shares outstanding. So I made a really simple example. If there's $10,050,000 worth of securities, stocks, bonds, whatever, and there's $50,000 of liabilities that they haven't written the check yet, you subtract that, you get $10 million. If there's a million shares in the fund, you get $10 in NAV, $10 net asset value. If there's a 5% sales charge, sales commission, sales load, then you would multiply the net asset value times the 5%, and that's called the offering price. And if you remember that, great. I hope you do. But if you don't. What are the advantages and disadvantages? Well, open-end mutual funds, you're always able to buy and sell. There's no market forces. They're very popular. Greater than 80% of them are open-end mutual funds. But from the standpoint of the mutual fund manager, large purchases, large redemptions can make the management of the fund more difficult. Let's say you've done really well out there. You're a mutual fund manager. What's going to happen? Well, people are going to start sending you money. And now all of a sudden, you've got to think of what to do with this extra cash that's sitting around. Because you're a stock mutual fund manager, you've got to buy more stocks. And do you go back to the stocks you already own? Or do you come up with new ideas? Well, everyone's different. Everyone deals with it differently. Some companies will close the mutual fund. They'll say, that's it, no more. We're not going to take any more. If you're an investor here, you can send us more money, but no more new investors. And the same thing happens on the way down. If people start pulling money out of your mutual fund, and you're the mutual fund manager, what do? You've got to now start selling securities that you don't necessarily want to sell, especially if it's a market downturn. But if people redeem their shares, you have no choice. You've got to write the check. You've got to send them the money. That's the problem with open-end mutual funds. Closed-end mutual funds, you have to buy and sell them like a stock. There's those market forces that we talked about. There's either selling at a premium or a discount. But the cool thing from the manager's point of view, again, we as investors don't care, but it's their problem, and which means it's our problem, is what it, they don't have to worry about people redeeming or purchasing more shares. Because once the number of shares have been purchased, are out there, they're out of the game. They get to manage the portfolio without having to worry about people sending in more money or pulling out all their money. Does that make sense? Yeah. You would think that closed-end would be more popular, right? Because it's actually a smart thing to do. No, they're not that popular. Would any of you, I mean, I say which one or do you prefer, but it turns out most all of you, maybe one or two, you're going to dabble with closed-end funds. But the truth is, I mean, I've never bought them. I don't have any intention to. Okay, so we see that the closed-end world is disappearing. What's taking its place? Exchange-traded funds, ETFs. They have been exploding over the last 20 years. These are open-end mutual funds, so there's no limit to the number of shares. They can always add more shares or take shares away. But they trade on the exchange. That's why it's called exchange-traded fund, like a stock, like a closed-end fund. There's no limit, but the investor must purchase the fund using a brokerage account. So you're incurring broker transaction fees. Well, some mutual funds are very clever, and we'll talk about Vanguard and Fidelity because they're the biggest. They have created their own brokerage firms so that you can go to Vanguard, you can go to Fidelity, and you can buy their ETFs, and they will waive, not this waive, they will forego the transaction fee. Not too shabby, huh? Pretty smart. So you bypass your broker. Actually, your broker is Vanguard brokerage firm or Fidelity brokerage firm. Actually, Fidelity, I mean, they have offices now. Down in Mission Valley, they have one. Have you seen that? What is it called? Mission Valley, right, Mission Valley, near Fascist Valley. And it's called, believe it or not, it's called the Hazard Center. So you can't, the Hazardous Center, I guess, it's called Hazard Center. So very, very smart. And they're becoming very, very popular, these ETFs. We'll discuss why, but first let's take a look at the growth. And after I did this, I thought, you know, you did it backwards. You did the first one from 1940 down to, and that's when you did the other way around. But anyway, look in 2006. There were 359. As of November, as all these others are December, but as of November, 1,285. Pretty amazing, isn't it? From 359 to 629 to 743, 820, 950, 11. But you see it starting to slow down. You see the growth starting to, the meteoric growth, and now the growth is still growing, but not as fast as they were. But look at what happened in 2008. 423 billion, 608 billion, 531, back to 777, and then a lot of that is because the market's coming back, but also people are dumping tons of money into these ETFs. They're very, very popular and becoming more so. Okay, questions, thoughts? All right, how is the mutual fund regulated? How is the industry regulated? Well, the landmark, I like that word, landmark legislation, Investment Company of Act of 1940, is the foundation of the modern mutual fund industry. It defined what is called a regulated investment company with pass-through investment rewards. If you're a company or you're an individual and you make money buying and selling stocks or buying and selling shoes or pizzas or whatever, what does the IRS do? Excuse me, you got it yours. But the mutual fund company said, no, you don't understand. We're not doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for our investors. Well, that's what a corporation does, doesn't it? It makes money, and it does it on behalf of the shareholders, stockholders, and the corporations are charged taxes, and then the shareholders are charged taxes. But the mutual fund industry said, no, we're not doing it. We're not in it for ourselves. So this is what the Investment Company Act of 1940 did. It defined a regulated investment company that passes through all the rewards, all the rent, well, it's a real estate investment trust, all the dividends, capital gains, interest payments to its individual shareholders. And then who pays the taxes? The shareholders. Make sense? We take it for granted now. But before the Investment Company Act, there was a little bit of, how are we going to handle these things? To qualify as an investment company must hold all of its assets as investments in stocks, bonds, or other traditional securities. And they have very limited ability. They have a little bit of ability, but for the most part, they are not allowed to get involved in derivatives or other risky strategies. Do you remember the definition of derivatives? Speculative, gambling, right. And they must use no more than 5% of their assets when acquiring a particular security. What does that mean? Well, if you have 100% of your assets and you cannot put more than 5% of those assets into any one stock, any one bond, how many must you have? You have to have at least 20, 100 divided by 5. So the regulation is saying, the landmark legislation is saying you have to have at least 20 stocks. Now, in practice, do any mutual funds actually only have 20 stocks?
No.
There's a couple. There, in fact, one of them is called Janus 20. Janus is the name of the company. They're based in Denver. 20 is the name of the mutual fund. And so what is Janus telling you? Most people have no idea why it's called 20, and unless they dig deeper. They're telling you, we're only going to invest in 20 stocks. Now, why did we buy a mutual fund? Two big reasons.
Diversification
and portfolio management. These people are saying, no, we're going to concentrate the portfolio. So the probability of you making a lot of money is good, and the probability of you losing a lot of money is also high. So it's going to be more and more danger, you know, risk, more reward. But most mutual funds buy 100, 200, 500 different securities. And they have to create an organization with checks and balances. Have you heard of checks and balances? You ever take a civics lesson? What our government's supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is. And this is from your book, and I would have turned it upside down. I would have put the shareholders at the bottom, but hey, that's what they did. The shareholders make their investments into the mutual fund, and the shareholders' interests are supposed to be watched over by the board of directors. The board of directors must be 75% independent. For decades, these things were basically rubber stamps. You're a prestigious individual for whatever reason. You're a professor. A lot of them are professors. Or you're a CEO of one company, or you've been a major investor, and you get invited to be on the board of such and such mutual fund. What a cake deal. They treat you like royalty, often pay you to fly around the world, 5-star hotels. Are you going to lose that gig? So, yeah, right. So a lot of these boards have been called rubber stamps. So after the 2002 mess and the 2003 and the 2008. The boards are supposed to be more watchdogs. They're supposed to be watching over the mutual fund. Some of them do. Don't get me wrong. Some of them do. And then the mutual fund itself is made up by various components. By far, the most important component is the investment advisor, the management company. These are the people with the top hats. These are the people who are making the investment decisions. But do they actually buy and sell the shares?
No.
The custodian is the company that holds on to the shares. You got it, right, exactly. The distributor sells the shares out to the industry, out to the brokers. Often they're called wholesalers. They go out to brokerage firms and say, hey, we're such and such mutual fund, we're cool, and they get the brokers to hawk their mutual funds. The transfer agent is the company that actually processes the orders to buy and sell. So when you call the mutual fund, you're not calling these people. You're calling these people and saying, you know, I want to take out $1,000 out of my account. They say, okay. Or you go to the website. You're dealing with these people. And then there's an independent public accounting firm, and you might have heard of some of these, Ernst & Young, Deloitte & Touche, PricewaterhouseCoopers. These are the, they used to be the big eight. Now there's about five of them or so. Arthur Anderson's gone. And if you're interested in this, you accountants, look up the history of Arthur Anderson. Their job is to go in there and certify the data. You say you have 1,000, 100,000 shares of Microsoft. Where is it? Okay, cool. Got it? Make sense? And so what these two slides are basically going through and describing what we just described in bullet form. The mutual fund is a corporation run by the board of directors. On behalf of the shareholders vote them in. The investment advisor, the management company, has portfolio managers, sometimes a team, a committee, research analysts. These people are paid very well. They're sent all around the world. It costs a lot of money to run a good mutual fund. And the distributors distribute their shares to the public, either through brokers or directly to the public. The custodian holds on to the securities. Often they're a bank or a trust company. The transfer agent keeps track of the purchase orders, and the independent public accounting firm certifies the numbers. Why the large diversification of tasks and companies? Well, mutual funds are highly regulated in order to protect shareholders' investment from fraud and collapse. When have you heard of a scandal at a mutual fund company? Huh? Until 2003, you never heard. Wait a minute, Piano. Did you just say scandals? Mutual fund scandals? Do you want me to invest in an industry that's plagued with scandal? Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. And it's not plagued with scandal. Since 1940, the mutual fund industry has been highly regulated and for the most part escaped any hint of impropriety. Like that word? Impropriety? It means hanky-panky. It means, right? In 2003, some practices that were not quite illegal, but obviously unethical, were uncovered. And it was only a handful of companies, a handful of people. But it tarred the entire industry. Most of the mutual fund companies had nothing to do with it. Poor Alliance. Alliance was one of the 10 largest mutual funds at the time, and two people were doing this at the company. And it just, Alliance almost disappeared. Another company came in and helped them, and now they've been rehabilitated. They actually have some very good funds. Poor George Putnam, one of the original mutual funds from the venerable mutual fund houses of Boston, was rolling around in his grave. And this guy, Strong, started this company from scratch. He was the CEO. He was the founder. He was the owner. At the time, he was worth $600 million. And what the hell were these people doing? Well, let me try to explain to you. Let's say you're watching the markets. And more, the stock markets around the world have been moving in lockstep. It didn't used to be this way. They still don't always move in lockstep. But guaranteed, maybe 90%, if the market tanks in the U.S., after it closes at 4 o'clock Eastern time, 1 o'clock our time, 2 hours later, it's going to open up in Japan and Hong Kong and Australia. But because of the Investment Company Act of 1940, the prices are set at 4 o'clock Eastern time, New York time. So you have a Japanese fund. And you know that in a few hours, the Japanese market's going to open, and the chances are that that market's going to tank. So what do? You sell your Japanese mutual fund today, knowing or have a good feeling that's going to fall tomorrow or, you know, in a few hours in Asia. And then the next day you buy it back. You see what you just did? You're shorting, exactly. You're shorting this mutual fund, but that's not what mutual funds are for. Mutual funds are long-term investments. But it wasn't illegal. Some companies just wouldn't allow it. Some companies, if you sell, you can't buy back for 30 days. Or, if you buy back, we're going to hit you with a 2% fee. But other companies said, well, I guess so. And so this guy was doing that with his own funds. He was selling them, buying them back the next day. Now, is there really something wrong with that? Yeah. You're increasing fees for everybody else. You're basically stealing pennies from people. You see what you're saying? But if you have a million shareholders, stealing a penny is not too bad. Not too shabby. It's only $10,000, right? And this guy made about 80 grand doing this. What? Stupid. He came clean. He's barred from the industry for life. I mean, don't worry about the guy. He's plenty rich. But he's destroyed his reputation. He apologized to his family, his friends, the industry. Oh, he's still rich. Yeah, don't feel too bad for him. But I'll tell you, I'd much rather have my name than $600 million, okay? You understand? Yes. Maybe I wouldn't. I don't know. I'll have to think about that. Yes.
With his personal money.
Okay,
so then he would sell it here, buy it there, and make that profit.
Make that whatever 1% or so. But if you do that enough times, you know, you'll do pretty well. Okay. He wasn't the only one. Don't get me wrong.
I was thinking it was the company.
No. This is his own money.
Okay.
But it was his own funds. And so instead of losing $99,999 on a $100,000 account, Enron, WorldCom, hanky panky. Investors lost maybe 20 cents or 15 cents. Is it wrong?
Yeah.
Yes. Is it going to happen again? No. Because the companies now have safeguards to not let it happen again. And as I said, it was only a handful.
He's the first and only one to do that. I guess he got a name.
What was something? Richard Strong? He wasn't the only one. Janus Bank of Armenia?
But I'm saying that if they lost their name, their standing, but they got the name of being able to do that because no one could do it.
Nobody, not allowed to do it. Not allowed to do it. Most companies have safeguards involved. Okay. Or you can do it with ETFs. Because ETFs are bought and sold like stocks throughout the day. You're going to incur transaction costs, but that's okay. That's all right, because you're the one incurring the transaction costs. And the mutual fund company doesn't have to worry because they're not involved. Okay, how are we doing? Yes, sir.
So the first one was wrong because you're always paying the transaction costs.
What you're doing, is you're increasing the cost for your fellow shareholders. You're using the mutual fund, or at least they were. Come on in, have a seat. Scott? Are you Scott? No, okay. Have a seat, please. You're increasing the transaction cost for your fellow shareholders. So not good. Here's a seat over here. Come on over here. Keep coming. There's a seat right over here. Yeah. You're welcome. So you're increasing the transaction cost for your fellow shareholders. So you're basically stealing, pieces of a penny. Yes.
But it's an open-end fund. You can buy and sell as you please. I don't quite follow the illegality here.
Well, I don't know if it's made illegal, but companies now have safeguards involved. For example, some companies like American funds will say, if you sell this shares today, you can't buy them back for another 30 days. So you can't play fast and loose with that. You know, 30 days later, you want to do it, fine.
Is it because of results? I'm trying to understand. If I have an account in San Francisco and I have an account in Tokyo and I sell here and then buy it.
No. Don't confuse. The mutual funds are the open end mutual funds are always priced at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's why they were using a Japanese fund. You understand? Or some other fund where they knew the prices were a day late. Are you with me? You understand what's going on here? The world keeps moving around. It doesn't stop. The world keeps spinning. And so 2 or 3 hours after, I think it's only 2 hours, after New York closes, Japan opens up. New Zealand opens up. Make sense? No, am I losing? Yeah, say it.
I think it was just frowned upon and unethical. I don't think it was illegal.
It wasn't technically illegal.
It was just an unethical thing for him to do because the other people were paying the cost of him doing it.
I'm still not following though. Is he buying and selling the same mutual fund?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe he has a Japanese. I keep using Japanese, but it happened with other funds. But let's say he has a Japanese mutual fund. It's one of the strong funds. And he sees the U.S. market tank. So he thinks, tomorrow, well, in a few hours, Asian time, he thinks Japan's going to tank.
Right. Basically, it's a gray area of, like, insider trading.
Yeah, it's kind of insider trading.
Figure, are you going to predict what's going to happen?
But it's not illegal.
In Japan.
Yeah.
You don't see what's wrong with it? Well, let me just say, you're increasing transaction costs for everybody else. So you're stealing.
That's
right,
yeah.
Okay.
It's the same fund. Let's say the Genesis 20.
No, you sell it at 4 p.m. time, New York.
Yeah.
Always. No matter where it's based around the world. I'm not sure. I'm not answering your question. But just know that they were stealing pennies. Other companies will let you do that, but every time you do, they're going to charge you 2%. They'll say, sure, you want to buy and sell it within 30 days? We'll charge you 2% each time you do. And it's very unlikely that you're going to beat that 2% drop that you're going to get just from doing it.
The only thing he really did wrong was to do it where they had to pay. You know,
right. Well, they were mutual funds are long-term investments, open-end mutual and closed-end mutual funds. And ETFs, in my humble opinion, should be considered long-term, but some people consider them short-term. They use them as trading vehicles. Okay, let's move on because we're getting a little bit confused here. But I hope you've gotten the main idea, even if I haven't convinced you that that's what they were doing. They were doing some other things too, but that was the type of shenanigans. And again, it was a very small number of people. Now, fees, operating expenses. We are going to spend today and then into Tuesday discussing fees. And you're going to go to sleep, as some of you have already gone to sleep, but you're going to really go to sleep now, because this is not only boring, it's also very complicated. But you're going to be the experts. You're going to walk into that 401k meeting where the people in the three-piece suits are going to try to snow you about how wonderful they're doing for you, what a job they're doing for you. Don't believe them. And you're going to be able to point to the fee and say, wait a minute, what's going on here? I don't understand this. Why are you charging us this? Oh, no. So it's going to happen. It happens here at Southwestern. Because every single mutual fund, every single investment has what are called annual operating expenses. And because of the Investment Company Act of 1940, mutual funds are required to show you in a form that you'll never look at or understand if you did look at it. But they're required to show you. Are banks or life insurance industry, are they required to show you their fees?
Yes.
No, they're not. And they won't.
They do like the Wells Fargo shows you like their fees, like their monthly fees. Is that something else?
Oh, the service charges. No, I'm talking about what they invest in. The investment fees. No, they don't. You're right. They'll show you their fees for the checking and that stuff. I'm talking about what they do with your money. They don't have to show you. But the three main fees are management fees. I'm going to abbreviate. I apologize. 12B1 fees. Isn't that a great name? Doesn't it say it all? 12B1? Just, you can't You got to know what that means. And then the other fees, accounting and other fees. And those are pretty straightforward. That's everything else. The management fees are paid to the managers, the people with the top hats, to make the investment decisions. The 12B1 fees are annual fees to defray advertising, servicing, and distribution costs of the fund. And they are required to show you. Does Coca-Cola tell you how much they paid in advertising last year?
No.
No. They're not going to tell you. They tell their investors. Does GM tell you how much they paid to market their cars?
No.
No. But the mutual funds are required to tell you how much they're paying to market and well, obviously, marketing is a cost. And then we said the accounting and other fees. Now, this last one, I put a little line there because it only applies to tax-qualified retirement accounts, educational savings accounts, and the like. This is a one-time fee that is paid to the trustee. So it's called a trustee fee, and it's paid once a year, $10. I've seen it as high as 30, but usually it's $10, $12. And that's because when you open up a Roth IRA or a 401k or some other, 401k is a little different. The employer pays most of those. You have to pay the trustee to hold on to your money because the IRS says as long as you do that, we'll bless you and kiss you and not have to pay any taxes. So that's a fee that you get with a Roth IRA, traditional IRA. Now, what?
After a certain amount.
Well, some of the companies will waive it after a certain amount. But who's that?
Vanguard
after?
$10,000.
I think that's not the trustee fee. I think you're talking about the low balance fee.
Oh, it's a low balance.
That's a low balance. We'll see. We won't see it today, but that's up here. We'll see the low balance fee.
Now,
they'll charge you usually $10 a year. When you open it, there'll be a setup fee, $10 a year. That's going to the custodian who holds on to you. And there's a reason for that, folks. When you open up a Roth IRA, we'll talk about Roth IRAs at the end of the semester, but some of you have already learned about them in the Business 121 class. Roth IRAs are very cool. You put the money in a Roth IRA, and you do what you're supposed to do, and wait until you're supposed to wait, and all that money comes back to you tax-free. Now, that's not a regular account. Regular account, every time you make money, every year, you're going to get what's called a 1099. And the IRS is going to get the 1099 too. And the IRS is going to say, damelo. You know, give me it. give me what you made because we'll charge you taxes. With a Roth IRA, as long as the custodian, the trustee, holds on to the money, and what you'll see sometimes is the name of the custodian for the benefit of, and then you'll see your name. And as long as they do that, and they do what they're supposed to do, and you do what you're supposed to do, the IRS blesses and kisses it, domini domini, waves the magic water, and you don't pay any taxes. Very cool. Well, I think so. This is the $10 that they get for doing that.
They get it yearly.
I've seen it as high as 30.
It's 40.
Well, there's a. She's saying, and it's again. It's tell me your name again. Sorry.
Andrea,
of course. Shop, sorry. I remember your last name. Andrea's saying that the Roth IRA is better than the traditional. I agree with her. I'm in her camp. But there are other people who say no. The traditional is better. And what? And you know, it's not an either or situation. You could do both, and you can have the benefits of both and the disadvantages of both. Okay, now, trading costs. What you will not see in the prospectus are the trading costs. So how does an investor know how much the trading costs are? Well, you can literally call them up and ask them. But what is better for you to do, I think, is just look at the annual turnover. The annual turnover must be declared. It's on the websites. You can find it. It's on their prospectus. It's a measure of how much trading a mutual fund does every year. And it's measured in a percentage that describes how much they turn over their portfolio. So if you see a turnover of 100%, that means the company has bought and sold every security in the portfolio They hold on to this stock with a bond an average of 1 year. Is that investing?
No.
Not in my book. But you'll see some mutual funds with turnovers as high as 200%. Which means they're holding on to a stock or a bond for an average of 6 months. 50% means 2 years. 25%, 4 years. Does that make sense? See what's going on here? The higher the turnover, obviously the higher the transaction cost. Now, they get a much better deal when they buy 1,000 shares or 10,000 shares than you and I are going to get when we buy that many shares. But still, they incur costs. So if you find a mutual fund with 20-25% turnover, you know that they're holding onto the security an average of 4 or 5 years. And why is that such a cool number? We're going to come back to that later on, because that's a well-run mutual fund, in my humble opinion, will hold on to their securities 3, 4, 5 years. Some might hold on to it longer. Some, if it's an aggressive growth fund, are they going to hold on to a stock for 4 years? No, you're going to expect to see 100, 200% return. But you're asking for it then. You're asking for something that's more trading as opposed to, in my opinion, investing. And again, we'll discuss that later on, one of the problems of putting mutual funds before that. Make sense? Make sense? Okay, great. Now, the eternal debate of whether you should buy a loan fund, sales load, sales charge, sales commission, whatever you want to call it. The industry calls it a sales load. Or should you buy a no-load fund? And we'll go through this, and then we'll review it again. And we come back, we'll actually start looking at, we don't have time to go look at the individual mutual funds. And for some of you, this is a little bit of review, isn't it? You guys remember from, some of you beat the Business 121 class. And it's so important, and it's so difficult to understand. It's so difficult to remember, even if you do understand it. And that's, I've got to admit that it's a lot of it's design, folks. A lot of it's by design. Our industry, I apologize on behalf of the industry, but our industry is often accused, rightfully so, of doing its best to
trick.
That's a good word. I was going to use the word obfuscate. Do you like that word, obfuscate?
I'm going to say that once I'm not tricking
you. Yeah, you're obfuscating the issue. In other words, blurring it, right? Blurring it and making it so razzmatazz. Oh, you're smoke and mirrors. Exactly. Pay no attention to that man. So, why do they have a sales charge? Well, the sales charge was used typically to compensate the financial representative. The broker has to make money, and brokers normally make money by commissions. We'll see that commissions have got a bad name, and so there are other ways that they can screw you. I mean, I'm sorry, charge you pound of flesh. I mean, their salary. And then the no-load fund started out as a way for mutual fund companies to bypass the broker and go directly to the individual. At the very beginning of the mutual fund industry, there was only one type of mutual fund, a front-end, now typically called Class A, although some companies call them Class 1. The commission was paid when the shares were purchased. You normally, but not always, will wind up with lower annual operating expenses. So people didn't like that. They said, well, I don't want to pay it at the front end. I don't want to have to pay a commission when I buy my mutual fund. For you, we have the back end charges. Class B. So you remember back end Class B. And you say, well, how's that any different than Class A? No problem. See, our Class B shares have a CDSC, a contingent deferred sales charge. What a great word, isn't it? Say contingent. Even if you're asleep. Even if you're asleep, say contingent. Contingent. Obfuscate. Obfuscate. It pays to increase your word power. So say contingent. Doesn't it say feel great when you say contingent? It feels great. Reminds me of like lumpia when you say it right there. Okay. Lumpia. When you say lumpia, you can feel it go. So what? What and tasty too. What happens typically is these things will have a sales charge that starts off at 5% for the first year, 2% for only. Second year 4%, 3%, 2%, 1%, and then after 5, 6, 4 years, depending on the company, that sales charge disappears. So it's called contingent deferred sales charge. Make sense? Have I lost you yet? Darn. Okay, I'll lose you next time. Okay. Normally, these back-end load shares pay higher annual operating expenses. Huh? Well, they use the 12B1 fee to charge you more, as we'll see. But eventually, for most companies, the Class A shares convert to the Class B shares, which have lower annual operating expenses. The third type of load fund is called broker no-load fund. Wait a minute. You're telling me that this is a load fund and it's called broker no-load fund? No more. The Securities and Exchange Commission says you can't do this. You cannot call these things broker no-load funds. They are typically called Class C, depending on the company, and they have no upfront fee, no back-end fee, well, maybe a 1% or less charge if you take the money out within a year, but you're not going to do that because it's a long-term investment. However, the Class C funds often have, or usually almost always have, higher annual operating expenses in perpetuity. Don't you just love that word? Perpetuity? Perpetuity. It's so you can spit on your friends when you say it. It means forever. They have shares, they stay high forever, or for a long time, 10 years or so. Again, courtesy of those 12B1 fees. Hence, the Class C shares can wind up costing more than the Class A or the Class B shares. And the Securities and Exchange Commission says, no, you cannot call a mutual fund a no-load fund. You can't call it a broker no-load fund if the 12B1 fee is greater than 0.25%. So, Class C shares are now not allowed to be called broker no-load funds, although some of the old-timers just still do because that's what they grew up calling them. Finally, we move into the no-load world. The first one we're going to take a look at are sometimes called the advisor no-load. Advisor no-load funds. They have no annual, they have no upfront fee, they have no back-end fee, they don't have 12B1 fees that are greater than 2.25%, but they charge you an annual fee on top of what the mutual fund charges. It's called a wealth management fee. We're not your brokers. Oh, no. We're your wealth managers. And they charge typically anywhere from 1 to 2% on top of what the mutual fund is charging. Are you with me? So no upfront fee, no back-end fee, low annual operating expenses, but we charge enough for 1 or 2%. But we send you a bottle of wine on your birthday and take you out to golf. Yeah. And then finally, we get to what are called often in the industry true. Now, that is not a legal term, but that's what you'll, when you read the magazines and watch the internet shows or the television shows, they'll call it a true no-load fund. And these are companies that are bypassing the brokers, no upfront fee, no back-end fee, lower annual operating expenses, may not have a 12B1 fee greater than 0.25%, but that does not mean that the overall fees are low. A no-load fund with a high annual operating expense, for whatever reason, these can't be greater than 0.25%, but these can be greater than 2%. There's nothing to stop them from putting it there. You must compare the annual operating expenses. So when we come back on Tuesday, and remember, there's no football this weekend, so you have plenty of time to study. No. They can't. Didn't they cancel the Super Bowl? So they're worried about terrorists. when we come back, we will start here and look at some real-life mutual funds. All right? So if you came in late, come see me. If you're not, well, James, you know what you're going to do. If you, if you haven't, if you need the ad, come see me. This is the last chance. See you next Tuesday.